Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
What's good, internet? It is Monday, August 27th, and you are listening to Waypoint Radio, episode 182. I'm your host, Austin Walker. And joining me today, Danielle Riendo.
Hi, hello.
And Patrick Klepek.
Hello.
I think it's fair to say a little reserved this morning, after the, shooting in Jacksonville yesterday, which occurred at a Madden tournament. I guess it's one of those things. It's like, I think we have a responsibility to talk about it, but I'm also exhausted and I'm saddened and terrified. And so it's going to be one of those conversations. So heads up, content warning, that we're going to get into some deep stuff here. That is going to be, I guess kind of heavy, for the first segment at least. And then, you know, we'll take a break and then we'll come back and talk about video games. We'll talk about the fact that Patrick isn't allowed to talk about Spider-Man yet because of his embargo, unfortunately.
The embargo is lifted on me being able to say that I will at one point have things to say.
At some point you'll talk Spider-Man. About totally. So yeah, Patrick, can you break down the story for us? What occurred at Jacksonville Landing yesterday?
Yeah, there was a Madden 19 tournament at a Florida mall in Jacksonville, and right in the middle of the tournament, which was being streamed on Twitch, a gunman opened fire, killed two, injured a number of others, people there, and as people were fleeing, he eventually turned the gun on himself. There are scattered reports about that he was a competitor in the tournament. Maybe this is a something we can pivot off to talk about a sort of a reaction to this piece, especially as people who work in media, is that, you know, a lot of what's happening right now is the rush to figure out who this person was, why they did what they did. And I think, you know, often in these instances, there is there's a lot of media research that has shown that those sorts of stories can be actively harmful because they the glorification, even if it's not saying, you know, glorification is just, that doesn't mean that you're saying what a person did was good,
right.
Should be encouraged.
Right.
It's just the fact that they get a lot of nationalized coverage as a result. And it has been shown that, you know, that can create copycats. And so we are in that phase where there's like this weird, I understand the journalistic impulse to like try and break down like the why, like who was this person? Why did they do what they do? How can we explain this heinous act? But that runs into, I think, other challenges that I don't know. Like, this happens every single time. I don't know that, like, a thorough study immediately, or not even thorough. It's like a haphazard.
Yeah.
Look up the Twitter accounts, the Facebook accounts, the Instagram accounts. What did they like? Where did they post on? What forums? And that painter, it's not like we're getting a profile where someone has spent, you know, weeks figuring out who this person is, painting, like, a very thorough picture of an individual. It's you know, lots of haphazard things being shared and like kind of collectively building something that maybe will make sense a week from now, but then no one will be paying attention. And stuff that was harmful may have just done the harmful thing as opposed to informing anybody and providing any clarity or answers.
Do you think that this is I think it's fair to say that for some outlets, that's kind of a cynical thing because that sort of coverage gets eyes because everyone is curious. But I guess, you know, let's say best case scenario in terms of motive, in terms of intention, and in just general curiosity, what do you think motivates that? Is that people who just want to make sense of a situation? Is that people looking for some magic phrase or sign that like, oh, we could have, if only we had paid more attention to this, this would solve what is actually this deeply embedded cultural problem?
Well, there's no fucking policy solution because politics. I mean, that's what I mean. I mean, I think that's where some of this is certainly fueled by. It's not is not singular, but I think you and have to
say
imagine
that.
Just
to be clear, when you say there's no policy solution, you mean that because of like yeah, Washington gridlock,
because of America,
because of America, due to
deep embedding on the right, especially. There's certainly you know, folks on the left that participate in this as well. But yeah, there's a I would say, like I said, not singular, but I have to imagine what fuels part of this is frustration over knowing nothing will change. There will not be an active movement to, like, the why is not answered with a okay and, right? It's just like, this was a bad, you know, this was a bad person, or maybe they had a mental illness. Like, there are, we fill in certain gaps about a person, but then don't use that evidence to make any, try and achieve meaningful change for the future. And so in, people can't, I mean, you can, there's, how much can you do, right? You may, what if you live in Florida, where it's like NRA dominated, like really increasingly red state, in which like the hopes of policy change are nil. And so, you know, if you want to know what's happening in the community, like the only thing, like, yes, I mean, you should go out, you should like demand more from your politicians. There are actions you can take to hopefully try and move the needle. But absent that, or in the immediate moment, like, what can you do except try and process it by trying to understand why. So I think that's a very human motivation, and it runs into a very human journalistic motivation that doesn't necessarily always lead to the best outcomes. And often that search for answering the why with the person is easier than answering the why with the policy change.
Right.
And so the easier one is filling in the character sheet rather than trying to understand, well, like, what could we have done? Maybe it wouldn't have solved this shooting, right? Like, some shootings are just going to happen, but what could we have done to maybe mitigate the one in the future? And maybe, you know, maybe you're seeing conversations in folks that work in esports pointing out, like, we need to take security more seriously in the future. Like, that is a that is a meaningful policy change for the future for other organizers. That's going to be challenging for smaller tournaments that maybe don't have the money to do things like that. That said, this was a high profile tournament involving high level players, in which I don't even know if there was a security lapse, but I mean, like, those are sorts of conversations you're seeing, at least what I'm observing from folks on Twitter who are more connected in those circles.
To be clear, when you're talking about a policy change, you're talking specifically about gun control in America, and
it's mostly the fucking guns, though. Yes.
Yeah. That's the major difference between us and other industrialized nations, right? That do not have nearly the same mass shooting problem, which is literally an epidemic at this point, and have, you know, what's the main difference between us and many of the other industrialized nations? Well, they have gun control. They have strict gun control policies. So,
it's
upsetting, and
it's so demoralizing.
Demoralizing. Yes. Sorry.
It is. I mean, I don't know that I used these words on Twitter yesterday in my thread, but the thing that I keep coming back to, like, the most demoralizing thought, let me just put this out there, let me just share the worst thoughts, are that, like, it can sometimes feel like it's a foregone conclusion. It can sometimes feel like we aren't on, like, a series of highways. The future is not a series of highways where we get to choose the directions we're choosing. It can feel like we are in a river and, like, yeah, there are some branches and there are some, like, tributaries and whatever. But, like, we're going one direction. We're going down this river because someone 30 years ago made decisions and we didn't catch it then. I feel that way about – I don't feel that way. On my worst days, I feel that way. I don't want to represent that as, like, my daily feeling. But in the wake of something like this, when I think about the situation that we are in with climate control, with gun control, when I think about the situation – there are places where I think that's a little more flexible, right? I think about, like, the situation with healthcare, like, seeing people talk about single payer, like, commonly now is
Medicare for all.
Exactly. Like, that stuff is buoys me a little bit. But when I think about gun control specifically, it feels like we've walked down a path that, you know, you can't put the genie back in the bottle. I would love to live in the world where America just did not have as many guns in it anymore. But there are so many because people made choices, foolish choices, about policy for so long and produced a culture where at all moments, gun rights were being held up and guns were purchasable. Yet at the same time, there was a demonization of those who wanted gun control to the degree of vilification that made it seem as if people were going to come strip your guns away, which encouraged more guns to be purchased in this country. And again, like, this is one of those situations where I don't know the specifics of this specific weapon, right? I don't know how, the shooter in this instance,
if banning bump stocks would have made a difference,
right? I don't, on the margins, totally. In the same way that there's already lots of speculation around mental health, around, you know, around parenting, around so many things. It's so many people looking for that one magic thing that they could fix to stop this. And I guess, like, the thing that I said on Twitter yesterday, I'll just reiterate, which is, like, if you feel hopeless in this moment or feel like you're not sure what the solution is, like, one, if you're listening, you're not alone in that. That is not I don't think that's a moral failing to look at this and get like, what the fuck do we even do? I think that is a completely human and I think that's a great first step response, because I think that it recognizes our individual smallness and our individual inability to change this thing by ourselves. And I think that is it's a better step than, oh, that's because that guy was, you know, he mentally ill, right? Like, oh yeah, we can't fix people who are, which is its own huge, huge barrel of problems. Yeah. And which isn't to say that America doesn't have a mental health crisis, because we don't have adequate and available mental health resources for people, and we still have a culture of stigmatization. All of that stuff is true, but also, like, I'd rather you as a listener be like, man, I don't know what to do here. Take a deep breath, like, I can't fix this by myself, than saying, like, well, of course, the only problem is this guy is as an individual. And then to take that second step, and this is the way harder thing, which is like, well, how can we start to imagine policy changes around gun control? How can we start to imagine policy changes around healthcare? How can we start to imagine policy changes in our local communities, in our state, and then, you know, federally? It can feel deeply overwhelming. So just like, no, that is not a unique feeling by any means. And try to find those other people who feel overwhelmed and figure out how to act locally with them immediately. Again, if you're in a place like Florida right now, like, this is – Florida has been
– There are primary elections on Tuesday.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep. If you weren't going to vote, maybe rethink that.
And you know, Florida is a place that has had its fair share of tragedy again and again and again. Everywhere in America has. Like, America is not – there is no safe corner. And I think that to me has been the most terrifying shakeout of this, is like – my mom asked me yesterday on the phone if I felt safe going to PAX. And, like, I don't, because PAX is, like, PAX West especially is kind of a disaster for security, because it's not in a single building. Like, PAX East takes place in the Boston Convention and Exhibition Center or whatever, right? And so it's, like, there are metal detectors at the front door, and then you're inside. And that's, like, okay, well, everybody goes to a bag check or whatever. PAX West is like a bunch of hotels that you just like
hotels,
walk in.
It's venues all over the city.
Yeah, and so you have to walk around the streets. And like, I'm not saying I want more cops. I don't know the last time a cop has made me feel safer. You know, it's like a double bind in a weird way. But the thing I actually told my mom was like, man, I don't feel safe going to the grocery store in America. Like, it could happen anywhere. A friend of mine, his neighborhood grocery store out in LA just got, and he's like, you know, fairly well off, he lives in Silver Lake. Do you know what I mean? Like,
that's a good ass neighborhood.
It's a good ass neighborhood. They, like, a new grocery store opened up. I think he went to go get groceries. I'm like, well, I can't get groceries today because everything's cordoned off because there was a mass shooting here. And like, it sucks. Like, it's overwhelming. And I am often at a loss for like words of wisdom here, because outside of like, hey, get active in your local community. Hey, support political organizations who you think are doing good work. Change comes slow, and
it's generational.
It's generational, not, and it's
right. Like, I have hope for, you know, some of the actions we saw earlier. Yeah, like but seeing some of the stuff that happened, you know, out of the Parkland shootings, you know, I'm encouraged about the ability for future generations to slowly fix the mistakes of both our generation and generations past. But I do think, like, gun culture change can, I'm not saying will come to America, but can, but that's a generational thing that happens over decades. That happens over 100 years. Like, that doesn't happen tomorrow. Like, I think in many ways, like, it's a lost cause, but it's one that you can't, in the same way that, like, you know, climate change, like, it's lost cause in that, like, there is no magic solution, right? Like, The guns don't all just disappear. We're not going to do what Australia did. There's not going to be a gun buyback program, right? No. Like, and so it's more of like a long war of attrition where like minds need to change. There has to be a culture shift. And like, so I'm encouraged by, you know, you look at the numbers on how younger generations feel about guns. It's like those people will, you know, eventually come into power in a way where they can enact change. And those are the people that are going to make, they're going to make changes that will affect their kids. And like, that's how that stuff changes. It just happens at such a long stretch of time that it can feel real dispiriting, especially if like, yes, like we were telling people like, go look at your local politics. Well, what if your local politics is fucked and actually you can't
and also you can't move and also you,
Or you've been disenfranchised.
Right. Totally.
As happened a lot in Florida, actually.
Florida's about to vote to give a bunch of people back their right to vote, though, in November. They have a ballot initiative that's going to give back a bunch of folks who've been to prison. They can get their right back to vote. So, again, like those shit like that, go vote for that in November. Right.
Yes, please do. Austin, I had a very similar conversation with my mom yesterday about security at PAX, and I saw a lot of people on Twitter kind of saying the same thing. And, you know, one of the things was, she was like, well, what's the security like there? And I was like, oh boy, not to worry you, but there's also the aspect of this that a lot of security is security theater and doesn't stop a lot of things, which is really scary. And it's something to contend with. And literally the only thing that gives me any comfort, I went and bought tourniquets yesterday.
Right.
I literally bought tourniquets.
But that's the other thing you could do is, like Danielle, actually train to help people in a crisis situation.
Yeah, that's the only thing that gives me any comfort at all is like, okay, well, if this happens, that's the thing. I've had this sort of psychological journey of like not necessarily thinking it'll happen to at this point in life feeling like, okay, this could happen. And I would like to be at least have the first idea of what to do if I'm in this situation. So I would encourage people, if you have resources at work, a lot of workplaces now have active shooter training for the best things to do literally is hide, turn off the lights, make no noise, make sure your phone is silenced, and know what to do about bleeding control, literally. Which, you know, I'll just say right here, ABCs, airway, breathing, circulation, learn how to use a tourniquet. I know this is grim stuff, maybe I'm out of my mind for thinking this way, but it feels like we've gotten to this point. So those are the tiny things you can do sort of in your immediate vicinity if something like this happens. That, and as Patrick is saying, go vote. Fucking vote every time you can, whatever you can do on your local level.
Yeah, and I mean, here's the smallest, I don't know, but I think that the thing that I'm now... The thing that I am struggling with is how to engage with this issue with folks who you can sometimes tell, you know, like, all right, this person wants there to be more shooters in the world who can intercede and be superheroes. Good guy with a gun. I'm not going to intervene with that person. But there are a lot of people out there who try to walk that centrist line of like, well, you know, we can't blame guns for everything. And it can be so exhausting to get into, and I say this because this has been what I've been watching, very, very good-hearted people try to do in my mentions for the last 24 hours. I've been arguing with people. I don't want to say save your energy, but spend it wisely is what I would say.
Pick your battles.
Pick your battles. Like,
And sometimes you have to like go against those arguments that don't go anywhere to start building a profile so you can like identify
immediately
people who, like, you know, this is how I pick how to choose to who I do don't respond to on anything on Twitter when you're dealing with, you know, hundreds of thousands of people is you have to find a way to kind of gut check, like, is this okay? What is this person?
Yeah.
What are they bringing to this? Are they just trying to make me angry?
Are they just wasting
they know
my time
that I'm trying to be?
Right. Yeah, exactly. And like for me, it's like, well, let's have that conversation with people who are actually in my life who maybe differ with me on this, where it's an actual conversation and not just like a random person who says they're a lawyer on the internet telling people that he's right and they're wrong. Focus on, like, you know, hey, if your sibling or if your cousin or if your parent or if your kid like feels dramatically different about this, and I definitely think that those are the relationships that I feel much more responsible about and with my friendships, my family relations, than just strangers. So like you cannot You know, don't burn yourself out arguing with strangers on the internet. It is not worth it. It is not.
Well, and arguments like this aren't usually, not that you can't have fruitful conversations on the internet on topics of this, but it's probably not on Twitter with a rando, right?
Like a complete stranger.
It's probably smaller communities, right? Yep. It's like a Discord server that, like, you have a communal interest in a game. It's a message board that you have a community that you're a part of. Like, that's, there are places where stranger engagement can work, but Twitter is not usually, people are usually going into a, if they're coming into a Twitter thread, like, you're usually going in kind of like, you know, charging in with a certain perspective and, you know, wanting to
drop the payload and bounce. Yeah, exactly.
Right. It's weird because the, not sparked by this incident in particular, but like in my life there, it's, you know, I'm headed to my mid 30s and a lot of folks who are having kids and stuff like that. And the response to, and these are all people who have not grown up in, sort of gun culture communities, like that was not a part of like anyone in any one of my friends or even friends of friends circles. Like maybe there were some occasional hunters, but like that was just not, guns were not part of my life growing up at all. And in, you know, in part, I think it's sort of part and parcel with like a larger distrust in institutions that we can like specifically map and see happening in our culture in the last like 30 years, especially and people who are having kids. I have had conversations with friends who are like, have you thought about buying a gun? Like, then I'm like, what are you fucking talking about? Like, you don't want to own a gun. He's like, I know, but like, fucking, I got a kid now. Like, maybe I should have a gun. And I'm like, no.
What?
You know, it's, stop.
Right.
But like, I mean, and they're not being like asshole gun culture person. Like, there's they're thinking like, how do I protect my family? I've never given this a thought before because I didn't grow up around guns, but like, you know, I see what happens with the police. Like, I don't trust the police. Like, maybe I'm supposed to trust myself. And then, like, we actually have, like, interesting arguments where I tell them they shouldn't probably own a gun. It just seems like that's more risk than – and also, you, come on, man. Like, you live in, like, mostly, like, low-crime, like, communities. Like, fucking lightning doesn't strike at your house. But –
right.
But I mean, like, those are the conversations that I've had, like, constructive, interesting, like, larger gun culture conversations where people are coming from, like – a reasonable feeling of like, I want to protect my family. I see what's happening out there. Maybe I should think about this. And then that leads to like larger conversations that are actually fruitful about like, what could we actually do about, you know, shootings and things like that, where it's like, it's a heated emotional conversation because we're talking about like our families and like wanting to do right by them, but also trying to figure out, you know, that ends up bleeding into like a larger conversation that I found that I found to be like very fruitful in a way that other conversations, like especially ones on the internet, have not. Side note, I just want to make people aware that if you're like Google searching this event, I wish I'd gotten this up closer at the top, but there is a specific clip that's going around. It's pulled down from Twitch, but it's, you know, you can't erase things from the internet. It's been embedded in a lot of news coverage of this. It's probably getting posted on Twitter a whole bunch. One on Twitter, good like self-care thing is you can turn off autoplay on
videos.
Do so that's just good for like
everything
singing. But especially for stuff like this where you know if people are posting sensitive sort of videos, it's nice to be able to have the opportunity to click play and know what you're getting into. But specifically, there's a clip in which, you know, there are these players playing the game. You know, briefly see a red dot sight on one of the players. The feed cuts, and then you hear a bunch of gunshots. It's disturbing. It's not graphic in the sense that it's visually graphic, but it is certainly graphic in terms of, like, what your mind can imagine is happening in that situation. Yeah. So just be aware as you're searching around this stuff, you know, your mileage may vary and where your curiosity takes you on that. I'd listened to the clip myself, and it's really terrifying, but I didn't learn anything from it. And so I guess that's what I would say is if you don't think you need to see it, then maybe you don't need to see it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
That's fair.
As a reminder, I guess I'll say briefly, you know, it's wild. Like, it was 4 months ago that we did a podcast episode about guns and games. And we did the whole Guns and Games Week in the wake of the Parkland shootings. And I bring this up only because Patrick, you reminded me of the conversation with your friend, and his feeling of like, how do I protect my family and how do I protect myself in a world where I don't trust the police and blah, blah, blah. Like, I do think that there is a degree of nuanced conversation to be had. I'm going to let that motorcycle drive by.
You agree.
I do think, yeah, that motorcycle agreed. I do think that, like, when you start looking at things like that, there is a degree of nuanced conversation to be had. There's a great article by Yusef Cole on the site called White Supremacy, Black Liberation, The Power Dynamics of Gun Violence, which gets into that a little bit. And in general, I just want to, you know, I want to point back to that week of stuff. If you're listening to us for the first time or listening to us now after we did that week, there's some great stuff there for tackling this conversation because – on one hand, I think it's absurd to. I think some of the connections drawn between video games and mass shootings are absurd. They are reactionary. It's scapegoating. It's whataboutism. It's like the worst sort of deflection coming from those who are actually in the power to affect change. Yeah. On the other hand, I'm deeply interested in the way that games and the way that all media portrays everything that it portrays, right? I'm interested in the way that games portray sex and race and adventure and exploration. And so, of course, I'm also interested in the way that games, you know, show off and utilize gun violence specifically. And so there's a lot of articles in that week that I think are worth reading. And I'm kind of curious for both of you if events like this have changed your feelings on gun violence in games, if your feelings, you know, there was an article going around, people were linking to it in the wake of this, that was an interview with some of the Naughty Dog folks talking about, the Last of Us 2 demo and the gun violence in that and like what it was doing and how they got it right and how they mo-capped it right. And, you know, it's one of those things like you read it in a different context. You read it at E3 and you go like, oh, wow, interesting. You read it in the wake of a mass shooting like, oh, boy, we sure are devoting a lot of resources to getting the way a body falls and bleeds out right. And I'm just curious if the kind of ongoing like repetition of these events has changed anything for you too with violence in games or just like where your heads and hearts are at on this?
To some degree, a lot of this is reflected in sort of the types of 911 calls that go on as well. Huh. Like, seeing sort of the results of real-life violence can be pretty sobering and mess with your head a little bit and definitely makes some of this feel a little bit more fraught. But I'm also not, like, you know, the world's biggest first-person shooter fan either.
Like, right? Anyway. Like, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, I love shooters that have other things going on. I sure love immersive sims, but don't shoot much in them. So it was never really, like, my number one genre in the first place. But it does... It's weird. I have actually been spending so much time lately looking at GoldenEye speedruns, and I know that's an older game. I know it's not, you know, in any way realistic or anything. But there was a huge debate at the time when GoldenEye was being made about how violent it should be or how cartoonish the violence should look, especially because this was a Nintendo game, right? Yeah. And Miyamoto had famously made some overture about showing Bond like shaking people's hands or something to show he's a good hero. He's not really a violent. Oh, they wanted.
I think it was supposed to be like during the credit sequence. Yeah. They wanted Bond to go to a hospital and shake like, hands shake with all the hands. Bad guys to show that he didn't kill them and that actually it was all in, you know, like it was a all movie right. or whatever.
Yep.
Like,
all right, James.
It was a very
right,
it's cute though.
It's adorable. Right.
God.
But yeah, I. It feels increasingly a little difficult for me to think, like, wow, this gun is awesome. You know, that kind of, like, reaction that PR typically wants you to have when you're playing a game at a demo and they're like, how'd the shotgun feel? I feel, like, fine doing that in something like Doom or something very, you know, you're shooting demons in the face. Exactly, yeah. Something pretty fantastical. But I do increasingly feel a little twinge. And maybe I'm just, like, a bleeding heart. But that's also... It is. It has gotten a little bit more fraught for me, I think, over the last few months or last couple of years.
I don't know that it's, like, had that much impact on the way I play or don't play games. I mean, maybe that's partially reflected in that I've never, like, I liked Modern Warfare a lot because it was, like, a good-ass video game in a lot of ways. I mean, obviously, you know, the fetishization of the military and things like that are all a problem. Yeah. But, like, the left trigger, right trigger in that game was... exceptional.
Ooh, yeah,
and so,
there it is.
there So I don't know. Like I do play, I play a lot of first person shooters, but I also think like those military style first person shooters have also fallen out of favor in a lot of ways. Like
it was at the height post played.
Right. Right. So like, I mean, I think like sort of the, you know, Modern Warfare really kicked off, you know, roughly 10 years of that becoming like a real point of emphasis, like Medal of Honor.
Battlegrounds was like is actually probably the last one that you played. And that's not the same thing, but
no. But yeah, I guess Battlegrounds like falls is sort of like is adjacent to that. Even though I feel like it's on a different track than like the kind of thing that Modern Warfare, Medal of Honors, and you know, I mean, I guess maybe like peak that type of game was fucking what was the police one you wrote about this one?
Battlefield or Hardline,
Hardline, right? Like that in some ways felt like it hitting a certain peak and falling off. And, you know, we still have and then there's been a retreat to sort of classical war, right? Like, right. We're with, you know, Battlefield, Call of Duty going to, you know, World War One and World War Two. So I don't know. It feels like games have shifted away from, like, a specific type. But, like, in terms of whether these events have, like, I don't want to play a game that, like, feels real good in the shooty. Like, I don't know if that's changed that much. Like, if Destiny 3 came out, I'm not that interested in the Destiny expansion, but, like, I guess maybe I do prefer, like, ones that are set in fantasy settings.
Something.
But that's,
but
that's less a reflection of, like, real world events and more just, I think it's more, game design is more interesting when they can free themselves.
Fuck around
to do
a little bit with some magic powers and some grappling hooks.
Like, maybe this person, like, because I didn't grow up in any sort of like gun culture household or community, like I have no inherent, like there's nothing about like a realistically modeled AK-47 that does anything
for
me.
You. Yeah, totally. It's weird. Cause, like, I definitely also didn't come from a gun culture to anything. I was not a gun family. We were not hunters. We did not have, there's no one in my life who like uses guns on the regular. That's, I mean, outside of like military personnel in my family, you know?
Right.
But I definitely, I am, it's such a weird thing. I think actually this is, you know, I'm going to talk about giant robots for a second.
Please.
You know,
of course.
Me. Every once in a while, someone, you might be listening to this right now, someone will link me to something where, like, Japan and America are going to make a giant robot. Companies in Japan and America are going to make giant robots, and they're going to fight. Isn't this awesome? Or, like, oh, wow, what if Trump's Space Force had robots? Or whatever, right? Like, those sorts of people link me to those things. Right. Like, oh, awesome, let's be excited about it. Like, no. Like, no. I never want there to be giant robots in my fucking lifetime. Like, never in my life do I want to see a giant robot walk down the street. They're terrible. And the point of the stories that I love are that they're terrible. And at the heart of that contradiction is that I think they're fucking cool as hell, right? Like, I think that the design of my favorite Gundam models are, they're lovingly crafted. They are like, there's vents and there's weird kneecaps and the giant chain that goes around. And this one has like hook and like, it's like
the audacity is part of the appeal.
It is, but I mean, some of them are modeled like tanks more than like superheroes, right? Like there's a range in that world. And yet my favorite things in Gundam, like one of my favorite Gundam things ever is a show called 0080 War in the Pocket. It's about a kid, like an 8-year-old kid who loves giant robots, who loves mechs, like just loves them, like has toys, draws them instead of paying attention during schoolwork. And then it's like, you know, it's a 6-episode run. And by the end of it, he's like, his friends are coming over to him and are like, oh, it's time to play robots. And he's just like in fucking tears because he now knows what happens when people fight. It's really good. People should watch it. But I find
as someone that doesn't, has not watched a lot of Gundam.
Right.
But like everything that you've said about it, like implies that it's a show that doesn't shy away from like military politics, right?
Well, yeah, 100%.
So, like the show gets it's flashy. The cool robots are like, you know, a hook into it.
Yeah,
but it's also not just a show about cool
those
robots.
Shows tend
it's like
to be
the
about how war is terrible.
Cool
right. Right. Yeah. Exactly. How war is terrible, and how our devotion to being the best prevents us from rising to our various peaks as humans. Whatever. The point is, I've had that conflict in that part of my life, and I actually have it inside of games too, which is like, I remember the first time I watched there was a GTA 4 trailer. It's a GTA 4 trailer in which Nico either shoots, I think he shoots a dude down into a subway station, like down the stairwell. And I don't know if you remember this, but when GTA 4 was coming out, one of the things that if you were on a site like NeoGAF at the time that you cared deeply about was that when people got hit by something, they went into a certain sort of like procedural ragdoll animation.
Oh, yeah, ragdoll physics, yeah.
But it wasn't just regular, it wasn't like Max Payne ragdoll where everyone was like literally a ragdoll. Mm-hmm. It was like your knee goes out, you know, like it felt like a skeleton. And I remember watching that from my dorm room and being like, yo, that's the coolest thing ever. Because it feels so physical, right? It felt not visceral, but kinetic, right? And part of me still gets that from time to time. And part of me still does in a video game. Like, 3 months ago, I watched all of the reload animations for all of the guns in Far Cry 2. Like, on a video. It was like a 10-minute long video. I was like, oh, wow, those are cool. When I talked about Hunt Showdown earlier this year, I talked about how cool it is to load those individual shells into the revolvers.
Or we would talk about, like, we'd actively discuss this when we do our PUBG streams, but, like, recognizing the rhetorical disconnect between like how we talk about gun, like the stories we would tell of our favorite moments of PUBG, mm-hmm. you'd step back and go, yo, that's fucked. That's like, fucked why up. Do you think that's exciting and fun right. and like a thing you spent 150 hours doing? But I think it's okay to relish in that contradiction that like games allow us to explore fantasies, and like exploring violent fantasies within the space of video games is not inherently a terrible thing, but it's also worth recognizing like what you're doing and what you're getting excited by, and like trying to grapple with that contradiction and realizing there are layers to that contradiction that are not as simple as like, you know, a media portrayal of like guns causing, you know, video games causing violence. But it's also the truth that like it's exciting to like shoot a dude in a game,
Call of Duty or whatever. Right. You get that
like, getting
kill.
That sniper shot in PUBG like across the hill, and it bounced off that dude's helmet, and he was only wearing a level 1 helmet, which meant that bullet went through and it killed him. Like, fuck, like, okay, bad, but
it triggers that adrenaline rush, right? And yeah. Well, like, and for me, it's just like, I wish there were more things in the space that were aware of that and played with it a little bit. There was a moment I was playing Frozen Synapse recently, Frozen Synapse 2. I told this story to some degree last week, I think, on the podcast, in which I got a mission against Cyberpunk Tactics game where you kind of are a bureau who's trying to stop what is basically an evil AI from stealing a bunch of like special superpowered relics. And on the side, you also have to do missions for various factions. And one of them was asking me to interrupt a protest group from a group that worshipped the evil AI. And I was like, yeah, sure, I need the $50,000 so I can hire a flamethrower unit or whatever the thing you do in a video game.
Of course, come
right?
on. Don't have to explain so yourself to like, me, Austin.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah, you play video games. And so, you know, you pull up with your unit of, like, assault rifle troops in front of this huge open area that's, I guess, presumably like a lecture hall or something. And then you step out, and it's just, like, 80 people. And there are like 3 armed guards, and your guys aren't, it's not no Russian, you're not shooting into the crowd and killing dozens of people, but there was something about the experience of just like, my units stepped outside, took aim, and killed the 3 dudes inside who had pistols, and that like dispersed the crowd. That was terrifying. There was like, I immediately was like, oh shit, what am I doing? Like, why would I accept that mission? This is terrible. Because it made material and obvious the results and the actual spaces where when gun violence happens, how chaotic it becomes and how scary it becomes. And I don't need that from every single game. And I think there's a way in which that even that strategy can end up fetishizing it a little bit. I felt that way about The Last of Us a little bit worse. I think some of the violence in that game started at, we got to remind you that violence is real and that people are hurt and that this is scary, and ended at like, and it's fucking cool, isn't it?
Well, that's when you're like listing it as a bullet point, like we have like 18 different finishers. Right. Like, okay.
Yeah.
I know. I realize you got to make a certain number for variety's sake, right. But yes,
you're
like
pretending
even
to
as someone
be a Cronenberg film, but you're really just Doom, and Doom is fine, but Doom is selling itself as Doom, right? Like Doom is saying you're here for finishers. Danielle, you.
Yeah, I think I'm thinking a lot about sort of the fact that we're all human beings. We all have a certain fascination with violence from a very young age, and it's healthy to explore that in ways that are healthy. I think the biggest problem is that people don't have the kinds of resources and instruction and guidance for finding outlets that are healthy, right, in certain ways. I mean, there are so many ways to explore violence in, like, a healthy way. Video games is one of them. It's just, I think a lot of people aren't intentional about that. They just sort of go about, oh, this is entertainment, I'm enjoying it, and not think about, like, hey, it's actually okay that you're excited by this. Like, it's okay to be... It's okay to do kink stuff. It's okay to do combat sports. It's okay to do video games. Like, whatever it is that is your healthy outlet where you're engaging in some sort of consensual way. It's just, we're so bad at talking about this stuff. We're so bad as a culture at, like, actually understanding what's going on underneath that sort of top layer, or that sort of, like, very surface layer. And I do wish there were more games that engaged with that, and also that we had better ways of talking about it, frankly. Yeah. Like, obviously, we're talking about it on this podcast, right? But I don't think most people are on a podcast sort of wrestling with their own feelings about violence. And I don't think you should, like, shame yourself for being excited by these things, right? Like, right. I think it's okay to accept that, like, yeah, there's a part of my lizard brain that's, like, really excited when I watch two people fighting, right? Like, I do that all the time. It's something I enjoy a lot. It's watching people fighting, or... you know, fighting myself.
Or fighting yourself. Yeah, I was going to say, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, right? Like, it's exciting and fun and awesome, and I think games are that for so many people. And it's like, it's okay that you like virtual shooting. Like, that's okay, but, like, know that that is a very specific way of expressing that, if that makes sense. Like, know that this is, like, a very specific way that you're engaging in this, know what it's doing for you, and know where to, you know, kind of... understand the difference between that and the million other ways in which you could either experience violence or see violence happen in the real world. And that's that's where I think there's a massive disconnect.
That active presence, and especially if you then take that to that next step of being active to work in the world to you know, help push the projects that you care about forward. I think those two things are what give me some peace there. You know, the hegemonic thought, kind of dominant culture works partially in 2018 and throughout most of the 20th century, the second half of the 20th century, by bombarding you, right? Mm-hmm. The just constant input of material that has under it a shared baseline of assumptions around who the good guys are, who the bad guys are, what it means to be successful, what it means to be beautiful, blah, blah, blah. At any point, you can take a person and say, hey, look at this advertisement that shows what a beautiful person looks like. Tear it apart. Tell me what's wrong with it. And most people be like, oh, well, this is clearly bullshit. Like, this woman is rail thin. This dude is, like, way buffer than most dudes could ever be. Oh, you know, these people don't even look like this on most days. Like, this is just, like, a one perfect... this is their perfect day where they, like, spend 3 weeks...
That dude didn't eat sugar for 6 months.
Right, exactly.
To get that six-pack.
This one photo. Yep. And then tomorrow, by this time next week, he's going to have put on 10
filling
more
out.
Pounds.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, exactly. And any person... or most people can do that. I genuinely believe that. But... the way society functions, the way culture functions, is there is this just constant meteorite shower of information, of images, of ideas hitting you over and over again that make it really hard to take any one of them and actually be that engaged, critical audience member, right? You're kind of reduced into a much more passive position where your critical faculties aren't firing and you're not actually using them on the works that you're consuming. You're just like, and also, that's not that's not a personal failing. That's you worked 40 hours this week and you want to turn on TV and watch some fucking whatever. I almost said Almost Human, which was that bad cyberpunk Fox TV show, because that was the last time I really felt like I was relaxed.
It was like Human Cops and
it was
AI Cops, right?
It took
Detroit
place
TV.
In Detroit. It was called Almost Human instead of Beyond Human. Michael Ealy is in it. He's very good. He's a very attractive man. He's great.
Yes.
He's a weird robot guy. Great.
J.J. Abrams can get people to star in weird shit.
Because I think it was him, and it was like, who was the, it was like, it was somebody else incredibly... Carl Urban, who also is
Carl,
like,
oh my god, that's right.
He's good. Carl
it's
Urban
totally
is good.
Him.
He's good.
Yeah.
He's good. So that show was good. But if you want to sit down and watch Almost Human at the end of the week, and you don't want to talk about, your brain isn't in a place where you're like, I'm going to think about how this, you know, is a reduction of race relations in America. You want to, like, just see them go bust the cyber dealer or whatever the fuck that episode
is about. Judge Dredd, which is, like, the most beautiful violence I've seen in the last 10 years. But, like, you start thinking a lot about what's going on in that movie. And like, what?
What?
But, yo, that movie looks great.
Looks great. looks great. And so, like, that is the way it works. And so, like, the challenge, hot, here's a hot waypoint, you know, like the ice bucket challenge and whatnot. Critical media consumption challenge. When you go into a work, open up your brain, be in cosmic brain mode, be thinking about it, enjoy it, but also be like, hey, it would be cool if there were some women who spoke on screen. Hey, maybe it's weird that only brown people get shot in this movie. Like, just
should
have
I be
that.
Saying this to the people I'm watching the movie with, like, yes. As a commentary?
Yeah, yeah, just constantly.
As it's going on, make
every
sure.
Every 30 minutes, I'm just going to pause, and I'm just going to have, we're just,
got
we're
some notes
have a conversation.
Here, this was, I think this was, I think The Incredibles was cool, but have you considered that it's just an objectivist lullaby? Have you considered that? Because,
Well, actually,
I haven't seen Incredibles 2 yet. I hear they walk.
I've heard it continues the same.
Oh, really? Okay, great. Good. All right, we should take a break and come back and talk a little bit more about some video games that we've been playing and some other stuff. We'll answer some questions. So, give us a second. We're going to take a quick break.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
We are back, and we still can't talk about Spider-Man. Is that true, Patrick?
It's true. I can talk about the fact that I played Spider-Man for the last, like, 5 days or so.
You heard it here first.
I can talk about it.
Spider-Man has
Tuesday, September 4th.
Okay. Spider-Man doesn't have 120 hours of content. You're not saying you played it straight for 5 days?
No, I have not done that.
Okay.
I'm looking forward to sharing my thoughts, and it's definitely a game I've been tracking for quite a while
right?
Now. Yeah, so, and I think hopefully people get a good Spider-Man game. We'll see.
We'll see. We'll see. Have y'all been playing anything else? Have you been playing anything you can talk about?
I will say that I was really excited to play Guacamelee 2, which is not to say that Guacamelee 2 is a bad game. Like, the 2 hours that I played seemed like it was a fine sequel to a Metroidvania that I enjoyed quite a bit from a couple of years back, but... something had to give in the month of August when we were getting Chasm and Hollow Knight and Switch was a couple weeks before that, and
Metroidvania Mania as I
Dead Cells and yes, and so I played like 2 hours and eventually just realized, like, objectively I'm enjoying this, but I just have done too much of something like this lately, and so I set it down and was like, I'll come back when I've got a lull in video games, like 6 months from now, where maybe that itch comes back. But I still need to finish the endgame content in Hollow Knight.
There's a new DLC for it. The DLC for it just hit, right?
And I haven't beaten Dead Cells because Spider-Man came into my life. So I'll really have to get back to that in a week or two.
The way you frame that, Patrick, Spider-Man came into your life, huh?
How's that? Spider-Man came into my life.
Nice. Congrats.
He swung right in. Yeah.
He did. But if you have not played, if you didn't play any of it, if you didn't play Hollow Knight, if you didn't play Dead Cells,
right?
If you didn't play Chasm, and you were just waiting for that Guacamelee 2, like, the 2 hours that I played seemed like a good sequel. So
okay.
But it was just too much for me right now, and it's just like, I cannot. I'm gonna end up disliking this game because I'm forcing myself to play something that I just said too much of a thing.
Totally. Cool. Well, let me know if you wrap back around to that, if it's any good, or if it's legitimately good and not just like, good first impression, you know?
Right.
Danielle,
right.
How about you? You get your hands on anything this weekend?
Just a lot of Bad North, which I wrote about a tiny bit on Friday, and we talked about it a little bit on the podcast, mostly in terms of how just smooth and frictionless the onboarding and tutorialization are, but super briefly, it is a really, really pretty, very clean, kind of minimal... real-time strategy game where I've obviously had my turn-based strategy tactics fill at I was at 697 hours of Into the Breach.
That's
recently.
A lot of time. That's
just so much time. But I've been playing a lot of Bad North, and I really like it. It is
that's a
very,
month,
very
Danielle.
Pretty.
Danielle,
yeah,
that's a month. I just did the math. 600 and how many?
697?
696. Six as in mm-hmm. June, the month of June.
The month of June.
Okay.
Nine as in the month of September.
Okay.
Seven.
I guess we should, you have said in the past that like you've let it idle for like hours and hours.
Right now.
So theoretically, okay, well, there's maybe, like, what do you even have it idling right now for? You're recording a podcast.
It's just sitting there.
She's
it
just considering there. The board. Patrick,
I can see it.
Which means
she's
playing. Because, like, if a chess master
is
looking...
I keep it on pause.
I know, but if
like,
a chess
I'm just saying
master...
it's possible that the hour count is, like, closer to, like, 200 hours.
Oh, is that all? So it's not 29 days.
I'm just saying that's what... that's.
I don't think 200 is accurate.
It's only 2 weeks or whatever.
It's just a lot. A lot. Ben North is really good. That's one I wanted to...
It looks really pretty. It has a really
very
good
cute.
Look. There's Vikings. I saw some video
it's
of it.
It's cute Vikings. Speaking of violence, there is a little bit of blood in there.
But. Wow, that's true. Vikings got to fight other Vikings, I guess.
Sure.
You
got to defend your little island.
I need to get point. You. I decided this weekend that I need to get you to play Invisible Ink.
Oh,
I
yeah.
I get you to. Because,
plan on it.
Because it is. I think it's a thing you would like. I think it has a style you would like. I think it has a progression system where you're doing. It's a very similar thing to Into the Breach of like unlocking new team members, basically.
Perfect.
Lots of great little like puzzly. How do I get around this? How do I get through this? And also, I revisited it this weekend just because Phantom Doctrine had kind of left me a little cold, and I still wanted to play something with spies and that had like that kind of cool jazzy vibe. And Invisible Ink still has my heart. I think I'm gonna play some of it on the plane to Seattle.
I'm afraid to start it. Is the only
fair.
Problem.
That's fair.
Like I'm actually afraid that this will be the next like 600 hour game.
That's
that
fair.
I play, I'll just be like, cool. This is my life now.
We should
in video
find some
games.
Time, and I should make you stream it with me. I think that's what we should do.
That'd
at least
be fun.
At least one time. So.
Do like a Invisible Thursday or something. I don't know. Whatever.
Yeah, we'll figure it out. We'll figure it out. No day rhymes with ink, unfortunately, right?
So that's
a shame. All right. Other than that, I briefly want to shout out. The Virus and Threat Protector, which just popped up on my computer that says didn't find any threats. Thanks. It also popped up and said, "Hey, your camera is bad," which is fun. That's good. Thank you, computer. Am I back?
Back.
Yeah, I think the virus thing actually.
The virus gave you a little.
Yeah, it did.
Yeah,
it did.
Little sneeze.
The other thing I've been playing, I want to shout out briefly. We talked about mechs in the first half. I finally put a bunch of time into Heaven Will Be Mine, which is the spiritual successor to We Know the Devil, a visual novel that is by a group of people. I think the name of the studio is Worst Girl Games, I believe is the name of the studio, which is a great fucking
right.
name. It's published by Pillow Fight Games, who publishes a bunch of VNs, visual novels. This is by two people who I'm friendly with, and also by written by AVB, who's written for Waypoint. So complete disclosure, my bias is through the roof. My bias is through the roof because it's a really pretty game about giant robots and queer people flirting. I'm already I'm like so incredibly there for it. It's a fascinating game that is all the way on its bullshit. That is like. The thing that I like about it the most is that unlike most mech things, its deepest concern is with mechs as metaphor for bodies and with the question of like, hey, what do we do with the future? Like, for us on the margins, how do we here's like the core conflict is there's kind of three groups. The setup is fucking great. Here's the very basic setup. Let's say 50 years ago, in the 1950s, this game takes place in the 80s, actually, which is weird, alternate 1980s. In the 1950s, humanity detected an existential threat on the margins of the solar system. And so they built giant robots because you needed to face an existential threat in space, and you needed to face it as a person, right? It's an existential threat. It's not just, like, aliens who are going to come kill you. It's something that, like, gets into your mind, into your culture in a way that's scary, in a way that's like undercuts who you are. And so it's important to be able to get up there and like have hands and express yourself. So they built giant robots. And the three factions end up developing after the existential threat has been dealt with, basically. And one of them wants us to move everybody into space. Fuck the Earth. I'm not going home. You can't ever go back. We're moving into the future. We're moving into space. One of the factions wants us to move beyond human altogether and say, like, fuck human bodies. Like, we're post-human. We are, you know, one with the ether itself. And one group says, like, no, you can't run away from Earth's problems. I don't care if you turn yourself into an alien. I don't care if you move to the moon. There's going to be problems because we're people. And we need to come back and face those. And each of those factions is given a character, but those characters are not by any means tied, like, loyal to those factions. And so the structure of the game is just, like, you take on a mission, and a mission is, like, a little vignette between you and one of your rival pilots from one of those other groups, flirting. And you decide, like, hey, does this go well for me and my faction, or do I kind of do the wrong thing because it gets me closer to this other pilot? And it's just like, it's beautiful. It's really extra. It's like, so like one of the mechs absolutely fights by building black holes and like neutron stars in the middle of combat. While
it's super dangerous.
Another one just has a gun. Like you're fighting it. Like, I just have a gun. What are my choices? Like, this isn't, how am I supposed to come out on
this? You could have had neuron stars and you chose a gun.
You couldn't have, because you're from the Earth faction who just has this old busted up unit from the first war, right?
You're a Riftwalker.
Yeah, exactly. Versus someone who is way, way more than just a Riftwalker. The characters are really cool. It's a very funny game. It's a very, like, it's a very 2018 game. There's lots of like, I don't want to say like memes, because it's not memey, but it has the sense of conversation that like I have had with real people, right? There is the relationship between like one of the characters that I think that they suggest you start with is Saturn, who is this like very snarky, like queer woman who is she pilots a mech that can cheat time and space, which, again, better than having a gun, in my opinion.
Yep.
It has a knife that poisons other mechs. And
hold on.
What's up?
With what?
Like acid?
It's like neurotoxin poison?
Sure, that sounds like some bullshit.
It's some bullshit. and also looks really cool. In any case, that character is really snarky in a way, and like has text chats with other characters in a way where it's just like, I've received these texts from friends of mine, you know, like
Mech the Knife. Is that,
no, it's not
name?
Called Mech the Knife.
Sure.
I appreciate it. Now they all have cool, weird space names. Like the one that can make like black holes is called Kroon Makula, which is the westernmost of the equatorial dark regions on Pluto. And that series of dark regions on Pluto is actually also called the Brass Knuckles of Pluto, which is a dope name to give something on Pluto. Anyway, it's cool.
Nice.
I'm really enjoying it. Again, disclosure with this one, but I really think it's worth checking out if you haven't. That's called Heaven Will Be Mine.
I need to play
it. You should play
it.
You should play
it. Sounds like my kind of thing.
Absolutely. Do y'all want to take a quick dip in the bucket where I keep all the questions at?
Let me take one.
Take one. You just do one little dip here.
Yeah, a little dip.
That sounds good to me. okay. Let's see. This is a good one. I actually like this one a lot. As long as you didn't ask this one the other day, I've not yet heard the Friday podcast, so maybe you did.
Oh.
This is from Josh, who says, "Hi, Waypoint Crew. One of my favorite genres of games has always been JRPGs, but I've had to watch a lot of cool series disappear over the years."
You did.
God damn it.
I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. It's a good question. I'm glad you asked it.
I just haven't had
a chance to. That's, you know what? That was the question that I pulled. You know what? Here's what we're gonna do. We're gonna really go deep then. Give me a number from 1 to 27.
Go ahead, Danielle.
We're really 26. Going to the bucket. What'd you say?
26.
Okay, 26. 26. All right. This one comes in from Guerrick or Garrick, G-U-E-R-R-I-C, which is a cool name that I wish I knew how to pronounce right, from Vancouver. Hey, Wayfarers. I heard you were looking for questions about politics and games. So, this is from right before the election. This is from 2016.
Oh, fuck me.
Boy.
While not specifically political, I want to ask you all about the interactions between American games media and non-American games. I want to specifically ask about Western games from outside the U.S., since they seem more likely to be discussed without reference to their country of origin than, for instance, Japanese or Korean games. While many prominent Anglophone video game media outlets are run and staffed by Americans, many of the Western games that garner a lot of discussion in those outlets are made outside of the U.S. by people either in other Anglophone countries like Canada and the U.K., or in non-Anglophone countries like Germany, Poland, France, Sweden, or Ukraine. These countries all have different social histories and political cultures, and it seems fair to think that this might influence the content and nature of games they create. On the flip side, many of these developers know the U.S. is the largest single Western consumer of video games and a hub of games media, and as such, they work to tailor their games to American audiences, or at least that's what they imagine American audiences to be. But even in doing so, they are inextricably creating from their position within their own country's social and political cultures. This leads me to a pair of questions. One, how do you as American journalists approach discussing games that have been developed by people who live outside the political and cultural landscape of the United States? Two, what are your thoughts on the ways non-American game developers choose to approach American audiences or not, and the impact these decisions have on both games and gaming media? All the best, Garrick from Vancouver. That's a good question.
That's a very good question.
I think I'll say for my part, I think it's noticeable. It's I think we probably could do better by it, because for me as a critic, I tend to notice it when those developers take a swing and miss. I think about something like there's been a rash of games about policing in the last few years. I think Cameron Kunzelman actually did a piece for us about this, about European devs making games about American cops. And
like, this is the police,
yes.
And the one that has the big donut icon.
It's a donut icon.
Beat Cop.
Beat
it's
Cop.
Beat
yes,
Cop.
Beat Cop.
Yeah. Yeah. There was another one, too. I think there was like three in within a couple of months.
Yeah, totally. Police stories. There's been a bunch. And there's been more since he wrote that story, actually. And that was one of those ones where it was like, ooh, like, this is, your vision of policing is so, it so clearly reflects, and in some of the cases, the developers came out and said, we were basing this off of, like, Miami Vice and the sort of TV procedurals that have made it to us, and we love that idea of what cops look like. It's like, well, okay, you're really not, like, you've missed something. There's been the distance actually has impaired the ability to remark on this, which, you know, is ironic given how often American culture producers do the same exact thing or worse with everywhere in the world. You know, like, I can't point to, there are an infinite amount of games that I can point to that get something dramatically wrong about Europe or the Middle East or South America or Africa or a million places, right? So, like, that is not a unique thing to the developers of those games. But I think it's a detriment that the things that I notice the most are that, or the other thing that I think happens a lot in our conversations, like, oh, it has that Eastern European flair. It has that feeling of it being like, it's a little janky, but it's kind of cool. It feels real. There's a sort of exoticism that gets tossed around that I'm personally guilty of tossing around in the past, for sure.
A little bit of condescension,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, totally. 100%.
A little bit.
Which is, there's a bit of a double bind in that, like, I look at a game like Elix that came out earlier this year. It was an RPG. I want to say it was by the devs who did, not the Gothic games, but they may have made, like, Raven's Cry. They may have made, like, it was the Gothic games. It was Risen. It was the Risen games and the Gothic games, Piranha Bytes.
Okay.
And Elix was, like, a sci-fi, science fantasy, open world RPG, third person, super janky.
I remember this, yes.
But also really ambitious. And I never knew, like, I only played a little bit of it, and I didn't play enough to actually weigh in on it, but with my time with it, I definitely felt like I was torn between, am I cutting this game slack because I know it wasn't developed by a big Western developer? Should I be cutting it slack because of that, because it's ambition beyond resources? Should I be applying my personal taste to it? Should I be thinking about the audience from Eastern Europe? All of that stuff was in my head. And at the end of the day, I just didn't like it enough to keep playing. And, like, that speaks for itself. But I think that all of those things are definitely worth thinking about and talking about.
There's definitely been times where, with developers from other countries, maybe particularly Japan, but I can think of examples from European devs as well, where I've felt wary of asking questions, especially about sexism in games, or like oh, how do you feel about strong women characters kinds of things, where, you know, interviewing a dev at E3 or something, where I've felt like I know I need to ask this question and I will, but like I don't know how much of this is going to be different from the way I would ask this question of an American developer because of a cultural, you know,
difference. Kotaku did a really fantastic interview with the developers of Soul Calibur at E3, in which they specifically, I don't know who did the interview, but they pushed back hard on like, what's up with like you've this series has made a lot of evolutions and the characters are in a lot of ways less ridiculous than they were in the past, but like, yo, what's up with the boobs in this game?
Yeah.
And didn't just accept the first answer, didn't just accept the second answer, like kept going back and ended up getting like really meaningful, interesting answers that weren't at essentially just, you know, they wanted to make sexy characters, right? Like, and there were some really revealing answers there. So, you know, it required in that position, you know, someone pushing. But I totally share your not sure know how to approach something that you feel like might be lost because you don't have control over how the question is asked and interpreted along the way. And so sometimes it's easier to just ask things that are a little more, you can kind of guide where the conversation is a little bit better.
Yeah,
totally. Cool. Well, I think those are the answers we have for that one. Thank you for sending that in a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, whenever that was. If you have questions, you can send them.
2 years ago, I guess.
I guess so. At this point, August. Yeah, that seems right. Great. If you have questions, you can send them into gaming@vice.com. As a reminder, we are scheduled, at least, to be at PAX West. Do you remember the Saturday? It's Saturday at 1:30? Yeah.
Let's see.
Saturday afternoon.
I need to read this out loud because you... God damn it, Patrick.
What? Yeah,
1:30 to 2:30 at the Sandworm Theater.
Uh-huh. Please, yep.
There aren't... This is your... You wrote this. There aren't enough panels at PAX talking about the big controversial topics of the day. Gundam and politics. Other podcasts are content with dancing around the issue while Waypoint Radio cuts to the heart of the matter. Gundam, is it good? Politics, are they bad? Jory Austin Walker, Patrick Klepek, and Danielle Riendo as we ponder these questions and mull about Dark Souls 2. You made it seem as if I wrote this, and you did a good job at it. You really did a good job at it. I don't know how much. Just see. Someone messaged me, Patrick. Did you see this?
Yeah. No.
Someone messaged me and was like, I'm so excited to hear you talk about Gundam and politics. Like, genuinely. And I was like, oh, no. Patrick. What did you get us
Mission
into?
Mission accomplished, Patrick.
I'll watch a Gundam episode on the flight.
Good. I'll link you one. I'll pick one thing and I'll be like, watch this.
Yeah, pick an episode and I'll load it up on my phone.
Okay, great. On your phone.
One episode. Okay. You don't only get it. It's not a two-parter. It's not like you need to watch an arc. I need an episode.
All right, I'll think about it.
Okay.
So yeah, we will be at PAX this coming weekend. Our panelists.
On Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
We're flying out. We won't be around Monday.
Well, I guess really not on Sunday. Mostly Friday, Saturday.
Yeah, mostly Friday, Saturday. You know, short one this time. You know, listen, there was a moment where we weren't even going to go. So, know, this is it's a good thing that we're going to be there. I'm excited about it. Friday and Saturday, I will be on a couple of other panels that you can look up. I'm also going to be on the US Gamers doing a panel on Mass Effect. They have an ongoing podcast about the best RPGs of all time, and so they're going to do an episode there live. It's called Mass Effect US Gamer Explores One of the Best RPGs Ever, and that is at Saturday at 5 p.m., so after our panel. And then I'm also going to be on the Hidden Gems panel, which is has a really great group of people on it. That is Dylan Ilvento, who is the kind of host of this, and then it's me, Felix Kramer, who is fantastic. If you don't know Felix Kramer from all of their Giant Bomb visits, you should. Felix is fantastic. I guess they're currently a producer over at Polytron, but they've touched so many indie games over the last few years that they are they're just a great person. And then Khalif from Spawn on Me is going to be there too. So that'll be really fun one. That is on Friday at 5 p.m. at the Cat Theater. So you can look those up if you're going to be there. You know, we will obviously, after our panel, be shaking hands and having conversations. So feel free to come by. We'd love to see you there. Any other PAX notes?
So,
you have one, right? You're going to be on...
Yeah, the improvised postmortem is like a really goofy comedy thing. We have to basically create fake postmortems for fake games.
It's very
funny. At the Hydra Theater. It's fun. It's a fun one. That's the Hydra Theater Friday at 8:30.
And that is
that's my other one.
You, Pat Bear, Dave Lang,
Pat Bear, Jeff Gerstmann, Abby
Russell,
from Giant Bomb,
Chris Straub from Chainsaw Suit, Addie Slepik, and Liz Roche. So awesome.
That's right. It's hopefully it'll be fun.
Totally. And you can find Patrick at the hotel bar.
I'm away from my family, no kid, no wife. Let's do this.
God, all right.
You and the
Maybe
gamers.
Not the hotel bar. Those drinks are expensive. But
yeah. You gotta find the hotel a bar down is like the street. Yeah.
It's like what you do. It's what you do at the end of the night. It's like I need one more. Okay, go to the hotel.
There bar. It is. That's what you do. Especially we're gonna be in a. We'll talk. I was gonna say we're gonna not be in a. We're gonna be in a regular hotel this year. It's gonna be exciting.
What?
Yeah, we're not in. We're
I know,
not,
it's wild.
No, like, weird.
Holy
yeah.
Shit.
I made a call. I was like, no more Airbnb. All right? Listen, no more. How about this?
Just Austin got tired of staying in places with me.
I'm
I get
done.
It. I'm still
going to
no more I'm Magustas. Still going to go find you a... So, what, no, it's good.
What's that?
Is so, here's what's good. Is one of the really cool things... I don't know if this is present on Android. I've only ever used iOS. But, like, in the Photos app, they have this section called Memories, which is where it, like, will take... compilations of photos based on like location data or like a moment or like the last we've taken all the photos of your kid from like the last spring like and put them over like nice music if you want to post it on Facebook. It's a really neat feature. But you know the algorithm is not perfect and you can like help pick like take out certain photos. Mm-hmm. And inevitably like if my daughter sees my phone, she goes, photo, and she wants to look at photos. And, like, the easiest thing is to just, like, have one of those, like, auto-generated videos play so she can watch it for a minute or two. And over, the fucking Magusta, like, video gets in there of, like, me at, like, midnight, like putting in this Magusta into the into the microwave.
God.
Just makes it into the – every time it comes up, she goes, beep, 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 because she sees the microwave and wants to hit the buttons. I'm just like, God damn
it. So good. I love it so much.
Amazing.
Cool. Well, as always, you can follow us on Twitter.
We're going to Waypoints. It's Monday.
It's Monday. It's Waypoints.
Buddy.
Hell yeah. Do you have one? Put
yeah,
the right back
I do.
On you.
So I'm going to point people to an article over at Splinter, which is under the... it's like the post-Gawker. What is it? What are they owned by
Gizmodo
now?
Media Group or the...
Gizmodo Media Group. Splinter is basically like the new Gawker in a lot of ways.
Okay.
Yeah, and like very like sharp political commentary and things like that. Anyway, there was a really great article written by Paul Bless called The Myth of John McCain. John McCain passed over the weekend due to complications from cancer, and people are complicated. John McCain is an especially complicated figure that I think it is worth... reading an article that tries to grapple with all of who John McCain was, as opposed to, as it says, the myth that is largely propagated by a lot of like mainstream press that you've seen a lot of in the last like 48 hours, really in the last like six, like investigating that term, you know, there are a lot of good things that John McCain did, and there are a lot of really, really
truly
bad things that John McCain did.
Truly despicable things,
truly despicable war crime sort of things, and, this is a piece, Google the Myth of John McCain over at Splinter. Splinter's just a good follow. They have a lot of really great pieces that have put a lot of things for me in it falls in the same bucket as Citations Needed. Like,
who
if you
also
enjoyed
did
that
good,
podcast.
Also did a good McCain.
Yes, they also did like a short podcast So if you like Citations Needed, then you would also should think about following Splinter over there because they are definitely working in the same world. So, yeah, The Myth of John McCain is the piece I would point people towards.
Danielle, do you want to elaborate?
I'll pick
briefly?
A different Yeah, no, it's fine because I think that covers it. It was actually a short episode. It's called News Brief, Don't Let the Media Erase McCain's Far-Right Legacy. That was what Citations Needed did. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I'm going to point to another Citations Needed episode that I found really, really wonderful this weekend. I fell off a little bit in the last few months, and I started kind of going back and listening to several of those episodes. And it was their season finale. It's episode 47, American Magnanimity. Oh, I can't say that word. Mag Anonymity.
Yeah.
Did I get it?
I think so.
I think I got it. Yeah. Okay. Spinning crimes against humanity as benevolence, and it goes into the rich history of American war crimes and just horrible things in American policy that have been spun as being really good for the population that was decimated or interned or enslaved.
Yep.
Basically, the history of spin for heinous, horrible things. Incredibly depressing, but also incredibly informative. Really good to know. This is the kind of thing you kind of want in your back pocket, I think, intellectually, for whenever this sort of thing crops up.
Totally.
So I found that very instructive. So thank you, Citations Needed.
Yeah. Those Adam Johnson, Nima Shirazi do an incredible job on that show. There was a series before that on charity, on philanthropy.
Yes.
Specifically
on Bill Gates.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the whole there's a double episode worth listening to. I'm going to go really light with my waypoint today because it's been a heavy one. I posted a couple of videos this weekend of Larry King and Ben Schwartz. Larry King, there's a video. Did you two see this? Did either of you see this?
No, I saw you referencing it in a Discord, but I did not have a chance to watch the video yet.
The name of the video is Larry King Tries to Voice Sonic the Hedgehog.
Oh, wow.
Cool.
It's really funny. Cool. Larry King and Ben Schwartz have the most amazing chemistry. Larry King is, like, as an interviewer, he's someone who's, like, great because he has a deep pocket of knowledge from all the people he interviewed. I sometimes think he could be better at curating who he interviews, certainly. You know, like, he's just one of those people who's like, oh, yeah.
He's in a weird place these days.
He is. And he's always been kind of a weird one. But his Ben Schwartz interviews are incredible. There are two of them. There's one that you can see like all of. It's like a 30-minute interview that was from a year ago that they released in its entirety over on the Larry King Now channel. But just this one clip of Larry King trying to voice Sonic the Hedgehog, and then there's another 10-minute clip of If You Only Knew, which is a segment Larry King does where he does this like rapid fire short questions to somebody, except they flip it and let Ben interview Larry. It's both very funny. Ben Schwartz, you might know as, I think maybe the touchstone is Jean Ralphio from Parks and Rec. He's also Dewey, I guess, on the new DuckTales cartoon.
DuckTales?
And he's going to be Sonic. He's the voice of Sonic in the Sonic the Hedgehog movie.
Oh, what you're saying is we should allow ourselves to be excited about the live action animation hybrid Sonic
the
Hedgehog.
Do you know who else is in that movie? Do you know what that movie?
Yeah, it's a real. I am 100% here for both Detective Pikachu
I'm here for
and Sonic the Hedgehog because they seem like they're both going to be like, I don't know if they're going to be good, but they seem self-aware in a way that maybe they could be fun.
I don't know how you cast Jim Carrey and Ben Schwartz in Sonic the Hedgehog without being at least a little self-aware.
It's worth seeing, right? Yeah. Like, I need to see that film. If it's a train wreck, it's still worth seeing. If it has the potential to actually be, I mean, it's all like set photos of like it takes place in a town called Green Hills.
Perfect.
Come on,
good.
Yeah.
Love it.
That's good. That's a good joke.
Perfect.
Really good.
So definitely go watch that stuff if you can. It's all up on Larry King's YouTube page. Who am I? What's happening?
His YouTube page.
Larry King now.
Go to just Google Larry King's YouTube page and you'll see.
That's it. So that's fun. That is my waypoint for the week. I'm gonna link you both to that first clip immediately because it's just so good. All right. If you want to follow us, you can over on Twitter. You can follow me at Austin_Walker. Where can people find you, Patrick?
You can find me at Patrick Club.
How about you, Danielle?
At Danielle or I.
You follow everything Waypoint does at twitter.com/waypoint, at facebook.com/waypointvice. And you can watch our own YouTube videos over at youtube.com/waypointvice. You can follow everything we do in terms of articles and everything else at waypoint.vice.com. And again, we'll be at PAX this coming weekend. If you want more info on the wonderful Bowen who lets us use the track Miss You off the EP panel machine, you can find out more about that at waypoint.zone/BOEN. If you want to chat to people about stuff like video games and art and music and culture, you can do that. Oh,
sonicdiscourse.zone.
Sonic is all the above.
Sonic is video games, art music, and culture. 100%. 100%.
The Sonic R soundtrack is great. So
a lot of the Sonic. You know what? Sonic has good music. You know?
Genuinely, yes.
So that's just all the way through. So yeah, you've...
Hey Austin, they're making Streets of Rage 4.
You don't make me weigh in on it. You saw me. You saw me get mad about it.
You have 30
already.
Seconds.
It doesn't look good. It doesn't sound good. I don't think that's the team to make it. Okay.
We're gonna
now,
see
if it.
It
was Sonic Streets of
yeah,
Rage.
Yeah, I'm happy
4.
To like listen. Maybe I'll play it and make wow, this feels really good. But the music in that trailer was not good. It was not Yuzo Koshiro good, and it I don't think it was even Streets of Rage inspired chiptunes good. I think that the art is too soft and blurry, and I think that the 80s, like I think that the 80s nostalgia retro thing just doesn't work for me in that game. That game is from the 90s and feels like it's from the 90s in a way that, like, I don't need retro wave music or retro wave vibes. It shouldn't feel like Hotline Miami. That's all I'm going to say. I feel like it's going to go in that direction. Anyway, and I'm a big Streets of Rage. I love Streets of Rage 2 so much.
We'll see. We'll talk about the panel. We're going to see and probably play the game before our
absolutely
panel.
So. All right. That's going to do it for us today. We will be back on Friday with the Waypoint 101 of Shadowrun, Dragonfall. So if you want to hear that, maybe play through that game this week. It's not super short, but it's short enough for you to get through. So maybe put your mind to that this week. And then our episode on Monday next week will probably just be the audio of our panel, as long as we're able to capture that. And if we can't for some reason, we're just not going to have an episode on Monday because it's a holiday here in the States. And I want to take that day off and recover.
We have to recover.
Exactly.
Yeah, PAX recovery.
PAX recovery mode. Exactly. Love it. All right, everybody, that's going to do it for us. Danielle, what do we say to them?
Be good and be good at it.
Peace. I did a peace sign to the camera. No one's watching, but I did it.
It was good.
Peace.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.